little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julie Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
We're all connected up to a great guest that I'm anxious to talk to on this edition of Thinking Clearly. But let's not forget to tell folks how they can get in touch with us, give us feedback about the show, and how they can listen to or download all of our previous episodes in podcast form of Thinking Clearly.
Well, absolutely. We love hearing from you, our listening audience. We love your feedback. And we've gotten many suggestions for show topics that have been really helpful. And you can find our entire archive of podcasted shows. Just open up your favorite podcast app, search for Thinking Clearly, and it should come right up. You can subscribe to our feed and find our backlog of shows. You can also visit us at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
Well, Julia, give our listeners a little clue about what we're going to talk about.
Absolutely. Well, today's topic, we're going to be talking about issues in teaching and learning critical thinking, the value of critical thinking, recognizing unsubstantiated claims, including unsubstantiated conspiracy theories.
And our guest for this edition of Thinking Clearly is Alan Bensley. He's a professor in the psychology department at Frostburg State University in Maryland, where he teaches a number of courses, including Psych 155, Critical Thinking and Scientific Inquiry. Professor Bensley has published a number of papers on a variety of topics, including skepticism, cynicism, and cognitive style, assessing belief in unsubstantiated claims and psychological misconceptions. And he's authored two textbooks with titles like Critical Thinking in Psychology, A Unified Skills Approach, and Critical Thinking in Psychology in Everyday Life. Professor Bensley, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Well, hello, Bob and Julia. Thanks for inviting me to Thinking Clearly.
Well, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate having you here in the virtual sphere. You know, so given all the various topics in psychology under the umbrella of psychology, what sparked your interest in critical thinking?
Well, in many ways, my focus on critical thinking was enabled by my many interests in psychology, although I didn't know what critical thinking was until much later. I became interested in social science and science early in my life, and my family was religious, but liberal, tolerant, and very supportive of my education, taking my brother and me to the library regularly, museums, and on vacations. Just to give you an example, for a science project in the eighth grade, I dissected a cow's brain, which my father obtained from a local butcher shop. And I used a book, a good book by Isaac Asimov to on the brain to explore my work with the brain. Unfortunately, in an early lapse of critical thinking, I left the container holding the remains of the cow's brain in my school locker, and very soon it became quite smelly. There are two morals to the story. One, encourage your children to pursue their intellectual interests. And two, don't trust them to carefully dispose of a dissected cow's brain. In high school, I took a course on intro psych, but I don't think it affected me too much. But I read a book on improving thinking, another book by Eric Hoffer, The True Believer on Authoritarianism and Fanatical Belief, and Hiroshima by John Hersey, showing the personal cost of massive mass murder. I was intrigued by the idea of improving thinking, especially my own thinking, and also shocked by the extremes of unquestioned belief and how people's belief could justify the decimation of a whole other group of people who they didn't even know. Then in college, my focus was on comparative religion and belief, as well as modern poetry and fiction. By this time, I'd rejected traditional Christian religious beliefs and wondered what other people believed and if there was something in that for me. I became interested in psychology of religion and meditation. I began wondering how the mind was related to the brain, the mind-brain question. And at the end of college, I learned about Jose Delgado's fascinating research in which he stimulated the brain of a bull and it stopped just instantly as it was charging a matador. And this raised the question to me of, could the mind be physically controlled? Then after college, I was writing songs and poems, and I began working on a science fiction novel that maybe this is getting long for your listeners, but I think it's interesting. It was based on a Frank Herbert novel, The God Makers, and the plot involved a professor of philosophy in ancient religions living in a future therapeutic culture who's conflicted about his beliefs and his culture. Sounds like what I was going through. He unwittingly became the subject of a psychology experiment in which some technologically advanced entity uses their mind control machines to create elaborate hallucinations of Jesus and Buddha. Strange, I know. Although I never finished the novel, in the process of doing the research for it, I got interested in psychology again and especially the brain. And about this time, my future wife, who encouraged me to go back to school and to get something out of my study, she was more practical than me. So I took more undergraduate courses and I began to study cognitive psychology. I went to graduate school. I did research on hypnosis and attention and autobiographical memory. But importantly, in my graduate school work, I greatly improved my knowledge of the mind, how to study it, my writing, and my thinking. I was improving my critical thinking. I just didn't have a name for it yet. And then I got my PhD. In my first full-time academic job, it was in the Department of Education, and which was fine with me. And I got very interested in improving thinking, especially writing across the curriculum at first. And a colleague of mine, Dr. Ronald Reed, was a leader in the philosophy for children approach to infusing critical thinking into children's education through literature. I wrote a chapter for him from a cognitive perspective. And I began developing measures and technique strategies for trying to improve my own students' critical thinking. About this time, I met Dr. Jane Hallinan, who is a leader in critical thinking and psychology. She encouraged me to write a textbook, critical thinking textbook. And during research on critical thinking and various topics, I wrote and had published my first book, The Critical Thinking in Psychology, A Unified Skills Approach. And at this time, I'd like to emphasize just how important writing is, I think, as a tool for improving critical thinking. And the reason it's effective is because it's an excellent way to externalize our thinking, to make it visible so that you can see representations of your own thinking. And this allows you to reflect on it, refine it. And that's what writing this book did for me. I got much clearer about what critical thinking was. And I started to develop a coherent approach to teaching and assessing critical thinking, knowledge, and belief.
Let's talk about that book a little bit, because you've outlined a very clear pathway with a lot of detail. That's great. I was just following you all the way through your journey to where you wound up.
Probably quite relatable to the wandering path towards critical thinking.
And skepticism. So let's move a little bit to the structure of that book, because I'm right with you there. When you write things out, it makes things a lot clearer because you figure out what you don't know and what you have to say better. I was looking at the outline of the book, the second book, Critical Thinking in Psychology and Everyday Life. And I noted something in there, a reference to how the book is organized. So let's talk about how the book's organized, including the approach that you use called direct infusion.
Sure. Let me talk about direct infusion first, because that'll kind of clue us into the structure of the book and the approach that I take to instruction and relatedly to assessment. Some instructors assume that critical thinking will improve in their courses when they simply discuss complex questions that might benefit from critical evaluation, or when they encourage deep learning in their students. Now, having discussions of critical thinking questions, controversial questions, and encourage active learning and deep learning are both good in general. But I think the research shows that this approach, sometimes it's called the immersion approach, is not as efficient as explicit instruction in producing measurable gains in critical thinking. And this is because students lack the skills and know-how to critically discuss many questions. Asking them simply to critically analyze a question largely misses the opportunity to help them learn how to acquire the relevant knowledge and skill. In contrast, explicit instruction, of which direct infusion is a type, takes a much more direct approach to teaching critical thinking skills and related knowledge. With explicit instruction of critical thinking, the instructor provides specific goals for improving aspects of critical thinking, usually critical thinking skills, directly teaches principles of critical thinking, and provides guided practice in applying principles so you can achieve the goals. Direct infusion involves directly teaching principles of reasoning and good judgment in a subject area, teaching students various critical thinking skills, such as how to make basic arguments, find assumptions, recognize and avoid thinking errors, and evaluate information on the internet, for example. In my case, this is all done within the context of teaching students psychology and science. That's the infusion part. So the explicit teaching of critical thinking is infused or embedded into course content instruction. Students are provided examples of critical thinking principles and the uses of critical thinking skills in thinking about psychological science and psychology in everyday life. All questions used in assessments seek to have students apply critical thinking and psychological thinking in answering. Well, in the early part of my career, I didn't have a critical thinking course to teach, and I directly infused critical thinking into regular course instruction. I did this in general psychology and research methods courses. Then about 20 years ago, I began teaching a senior seminar using my first critical thinking book and teaching it in a standalone critical thinking course. Then in 2010, I also began teaching an introductory critical thinking course, the one you mentioned, Psych 155, in which I developed new techniques for teaching critical thinking along with psychology using direct infusion. This further required that I develop additional measures of critical thinking and use them to assess the impact of instruction. Here's more specifically how my new critical thinking textbook is organized to promote the development of critical thinking skills and psychological knowledge through direct infusion. And if I go into too great a detail, stop me, Bob.
And that's the textbook you use in Psych 155?
That's the new one, right.
Yeah.
Yes, it's much better than the first one, I like to think.
And the additional title, in everyday experiences, means that...
In everyday life,
everyday life means that all of these skills can translate over into no matter what issues you're dealing with, whether it's psychology.
That's what I try to do.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah. And so the first chapter introduces some basics of critical thinking, focusing on argumentation within a psychological and scientific context. So first of all, I define critical thinking and explain it from a psychological perspective. That is what it takes to think critically, because I try to get students to understand that. The components of reasoning skills, for example, relevant knowledge, critical thinking dispositions, and metacognition. To introduce a basic skill, for example, students are given practice in distinguishing arguments and counterarguments from non-arguments. Students are also introduced to psychological misconceptions and thinking errors. That's part of the book in every chapter. Then the second chapter distinguishes deductive reasoning from inductive arguments. Readers are taught how to analyze conditional if-then deductive arguments. One of the reasons I do this is so they can learn how to make predictions from psychological theories. An example of this is predicting from psychological theories of aggression, which we do quite a bit of. Readers are given practice in recognizing fallacies and assumptions, especially unwarranted assumptions and other thinking errors such as belief bias, arguing from possibility, and shifting the burden of proof. The third chapter shifts the focus using standards of evidence to evaluate inductive arguments, especially everyday arguments that use scientific evidence. Readers learn about the strengths and especially the weaknesses of personal experiences, anecdotes, common sense belief, non-scientific statements of authority, non-scientific kinds of evidence. And that's important, I think, because that's what a lot of people use in their everyday kinds of argument making and evaluation. The fourth chapter, and these first four are really the critical ones, focuses on scientific sources of evidence used in psychology and in psychological arguments. It discusses the strengths and weaknesses of types of scientific research evidence. For instance, well-conducted true experiments offer stronger evidence than either correlational studies or case studies, because only the experiments can show causation and are conducted on more subjects than case studies. The fifth chapter applies the ideas about argumentation and scientific reasoning in chapter four and earlier chapters to help students distinguish examples of pseudoscience or false science masquerading as science from actual scientific ideas, approaches, and methods. As in the other approach to explicit instruction and direct confusion, they're given examples, for example, astrology, phrenology, Scientology, facilitated communication, thought field therapy, and more controversially, Freudian psychoanalytic theory. And then they learn how to use criteria to distinguish one of these types of presumably pseudoscientific kinds of approaches from actual science. Let me just summarize here quickly. The sixth chapter introduces basics of how cognitive processing occurs. So students learn a little bit about how the mind works. And then I introduce cognitive errors that can lead to faulty conclusions and judgments, such as visual illusions, hallucinations, and memory errors. And the second half of this chapter teaches active and critical reading. This is done to enable students to critically analyze a discussion on whether eyewitness memory is accurate. And the seventh chapter, I'll briefly mention it, is on the mind-brain question. These are also questions I'm interested in, I think that students are. The second half of the chapter is a critical reading exercise on whether the mind can leave the body, the out-of-body experience, which is a very unusual and interesting kind of topic. So other chapters also include information that helps people to do critical reading about other topics. And there's a chapter on analyzing information from the internet, another one on diagnosis and the kind of thinking errors that clinicians make, so students learn how to avoid those. And then the final chapter is on writing and the use of language. And so I do some stuff in that chapter actually trying to help students improve their writing. Well, also they recognize examples of propaganda and the misuse of language in everyday discourse.
That all sounds really fascinating and useful information. You know, I'm sure there's people listening though who, you know, are kind of thinking like, wow, that sounds like a lot of work. You know, I'm just a person. I don't have all the energy or the time for that. And you do, yes. You acknowledge in the preface of the book that, you know, critical thinking is effortful thinking. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question would be, and this is something, you know, I think we revisit a lot on Thinking Clearly, mm-hmm. is, you know, how do you inspire students and other people, you know, just mm-hmm. us regular old people on the street who want to do the best thinking that we can do? How do we inspire people to make that additional effort towards critical thinking and more effortful thinking?
That's a good question, Julia. Critical thinking is challenging. I can mostly speak to what I do to try to get students to think critically. And it's much more difficult when you're not teaching students and they're responsible to you for their performance. One strategy I've always tried to use is to teach critical thinking using interesting, important questions. For example, each chapter of my book begins with practice thinking questions, which are covered in the chapter. And many of them ask about common misconceptions, these ideas that people have that they think they know about how the mind works. For example, many people think that the full moon makes people behave abnormally. So it asks that question. Or does venting of anger and aggression reduce aggression? Many people think that, even unfortunately some therapists. To supplement chapter 2 on deductive reasoning, I assign an activity in which students generate hypotheses based on theories and research on aggression that I provide them. And the life of the mass murderer Charles Whitman, to hypothesize about why he shot 31 people from a University of Texas tower. And this is kind of a delicate topic, but it's really a critical one that, you know, many people have questions about in the news. It's frequently asked, why did this person do it? Well, we try to psychologically inform that argument, that question. And then in chapter 7, we do critical reading exercise, examining the OBE, as I mentioned, and whether the mind can actually leave the body. Chapter 13, I give students the opportunity to do kind of a unofficial diagnosis when we learn about mental disorders and what a diagnosis really is, psychological diagnosis. In chapter 14, they learn about propaganda, and we use some real world examples of that. We look at posters and we talk about this historically, for example, in Nazi Germany. And so I think that providing the opportunity to think about important questions that should be interesting to people is a good way to go. It's harder to do that with the general population. And since I'm involved in developing a method to help students do that for themselves, we can do more. But I think the other thing that we need to recognize is there's levels of the ability to think critically. And people that haven't had as much exposure to it or haven't had educational approaches that help them do that may not do that the way we think they should. And we have to encourage that and tolerate different levels of that. But always encouraging people to look for good reasons to accept the beliefs that they have and to find information that's accurate and those kinds of things.
Approaches we've used on thinking clearly, a couple in line with what you've been talking about. For example, we've talked about cognitive self-defense, critical thinking as cognitive self-defense. There's a lot of people that are trying to manipulate our thinking processes, our beliefs. And the other thing that we've talked about is ownership. Take ownership of your beliefs, because it is a lot of work. It's a lot easier to respond to something on social media just to impulsively or in line with the groups that we belong to. It's more effortful to actually do the critical thinking, looking for evidence and looking at the arguments that people are putting out there and analyzing the validity of those arguments. So I want to ask a question about, I don't think you completely gave a definition. What is your definition of critical thinking?
Well, in my book, I start with a definition that I like from Robert Ennis. There are lots of definitions of critical thinking, which sometimes is a problem. But I like it because it's succinct and memorable, and it's got some essential elements of critical thinking. He defined it as reasonable, reflective thinking focused on deciding what to believe or do. And then I often use it to introduce critical thinking and then add to it. Critical thinking is reasonable in that it emphasizes the use of reasons to support claims. Saying it's reflective emphasizes that it involves thinking about thinking. And in my book, then I elaborate on this definition to create a working definition of critical thinking, which I refer to in various chapters. Critical thinking is reflective thinking involved in evaluating evidence relevant to a claim so that a well-reasoned conclusion can be drawn from the evidence. And this working definition helps us unpack the basic components of reasoning that are used in everyday arguments and also in many scientific kinds of arguments.
And that's pretty consistent with our definition. I'm not going to go over our complete definition. We've talked about that a lot on this show. We consider ours a working definition, and we invite people to help us revise that and shape it. I just want to respond how important it is to actually embed critical thinking in psychology courses. In general, we want our psychologists to come out to be critical thinkers, just like we want our medical doctors and all professionals, really, to master critical thinking and to use critical thinking.
And our citizens.
Yeah, and citizens. My background is in psychology, too, in one of my careers. And I remember to keep my marriage and family therapy license current, I had to take continuing ed courses. And I took a course on neuro-linguistic programming back there, where Bandler and Grinder came out with a book called The Structure of Magic. And my first question was, I raised my hand and said, what is the research shown on the effectiveness of neuro-linguistic programming? And they said, we don't do research. And there are a lot of psychological interventions and practices out there that are part of even professionals' continuing education that have been not very well researched. So it's important that our psychologists learn that.
It's the difference between, you know, evidence-based practices and other, I guess is probably the
way.
Right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of research, you know, it is an important aspect, again, to get supportive evidence for the things that we do and we promote. From your research on critical thinking and critical thinking instruction, what are some of the more important and interesting aspects that you've gleaned? And I think also, you know, something that I've kind of had a hard time wrapping my brain around is, how do you measure critical thinking or the effectiveness of critical thinking?
That's a good question. Let me add to another part of the psychology of critical thinking that I give my students. I divide critical thinking up into four basic components. And so this is more of a psychological definition, but we try to assess all of these. I try to teach them, and I especially try to assess some of them. And one is we assume that critical thinking involves skills, know-how. And for example, I mentioned distinguishing arguments from non-arguments, finding assumptions, recognizing and correcting thinking errors. But it also takes knowledge. If you don't have accurate knowledge, know what? If you're unable to recognize accurate knowledge versus psychological misconceptions, for example, or distinguish evidence-based from pseudoscientific kinds of practices, then if you reason from those, that inaccurate knowledge, you're going to draw faulty conclusions. So I think that's an important part of teaching, and I'll mention that in a minute, assessing critical thinking. Then the third component is metacognition. People need to be able to accurately monitor their own thinking and awareness of their own knowledge so that they can revise their thinking, regulate their thinking. And that's closely related to the Ennis definition I mentioned earlier, reflecting on your own thinking. But in psychology, we call it metacognition. And then finally, critical thinking dispositions. And these are similar to some of the things that are in your definition, Bob, that you mentioned. Critical thinking dispositions are attitudes, traits, motives, such as open-mindedness, skepticism, intellectual engagement, that make it more likely a person will engage in critical thinking. If you're not disposed, if you're not motivated to do it, you're not going to do it. And so each of those we have thought need to be assessed. And so to answer your question, we've conducted studies using measures to assess the effectiveness of instruction or improving critical thinking in specific classes in our programs and program in general. And we've sought to assess these four components. Of course, especially critical thinking skills. That's what most people do, but also these other. I have two studies I'd like to try to briefly summarize. If I go too long, please stop me. But we have two studies in which I think we've done this, and they demonstrated the effectiveness of critical thinking instruction. In one, my graduate student, Rachel Spiro, and I assessed the effectiveness of direct infusion of argument analysis and critical reading skill instruction in my cognitive psychology course. And to do this, had to compare different sections. One section got traditional instruction focused on knowledge. A second section got direct infusion of memory skill improvement, which you can use direct infusion in other ways. And then the third one, of course, was direct infusion of argument analysis and critical reading instruction. As I mentioned, critical reading instruction involves analyzing the evidence, for example, in a literature review that discusses a question. So the instruction was centered around that. All students took a critical reading test about whether memory declines with age, and an argument analysis test about reasoning and psychology. And students in the critical thinking instruction group showed significantly greater gains than each of the other two groups on both tests, on both critical reading and argument analysis. And in addition, we looked to see if their dispositions and their metacognition changed. And we found that it did. We found that at the end of the course, those students who improved the most on their critical thinking skills test tended to have the highest scores on a measure of critical thinking disposition, intellectual engagement, called the need for cognition. And this suggests that students who were most intellectually engaged profited the most from their critical thinking instruction, which I think is important to note. We haven't found much increase in actual dispositions, but there are individual differences in how disposed people are to use their skills. And those people who are most disposed show the greatest improvement. And we found differences in metacognition in both the students and the groups. When we asked students to estimate their scores on the pre-test of these two and on the post-test, we looked at the difference between what they estimated their score to be and what their actual score to be in a measure of the accuracy of their metacognitive monitoring, their ability to accurately reflect on their performance. And what we found was that students who were the least able to accurately estimate their performance were the ones who did the worst on the tests. And this is consistent. You may have heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect or the unskilled and unaware effect. That's exactly what's going on here. Now, after instruction, both groups, both kinds of students, the ones that were doing more poorly and the ones that were doing better and could estimate their scores better, improved. But all students remained overconfident. And that's a problem with people in general. And it's a problem with our students and I think other people's students. Students think they have skills that they don't have, and they overestimate how well they've done. But if they don't know how to do the task or they don't have the knowledge, then they're particularly inaccurate in their estimation. And we did another study too. I won't go into it in great detail, but we looked at direct infusion of teaching one of my classes, one of my beginning Psych 155 classes, focusing on recognizing thinking errors using the book, and another class focused more on recognizing misconceptions, both of which are discussed and everybody was exposed to, but some students got more instruction than others. And so we found differences in the focus of instruction, not surprisingly. And students in the misconceptions focus class improved their metacognition too. They improved their accuracy after instruction in estimating their ability to recognize misconceptions. And once again, we found that students who were more intellectually engaged did better, that is, profited more from instruction. All students were in both, in all classes were the same before instruction, but after instruction, critical thinking and direct infusion seemed to be effective.
Well, thanks for that good summary of your experiences in your research, the effectiveness of critical thinking. It's kind of timely because we just recently got a question from one of our listeners saying that we've had guests on before that have talked about their courses that they teach in critical thinking and that sort of thing, but that they haven't mentioned any studies on an evaluation of the effectiveness of those teaching techniques on people's actual critical thinking skills. So that's great. And I do want to remind listeners that we are talking to psychology professor Alan Bensley from Frostburg State University about teaching and learning critical thinking and a variety of other topics. Alan, from your experience in the classroom teaching critical thinking, how many years have you been teaching that class, by the way?
Forever.
Forever. A long time.
I got my PhD in 89, and I went to a couple places before that, and then I've been at Frostburg State. It's going to be my 30th year year.
You've been teaching for a long time, critical thinking and into these issues. So over those years, what are some of the biggest challenges that you found for students in learning those skills and in incorporating that practice into their everyday lives?
That's a very good question. Well, I wish I had better news, Bob, but often it seems that many of my students are not ready for the discipline and effort involved in engaging in critical thinking. Some are, but there are large individual differences. And perhaps this is because there's kind of low expectations for critical thinking in their previous public education. I don't know. Relatedly, their knowledge of basic science seems pretty weak. But I see that as part of my job to inform them. And I often talk about evolutionary theory. And when we talk about ESP, and I talk about how that's implausible given what we know from physics. And so they, in my courses, they get some kind of review of basic scientific concepts. But, you know, if you're trying to teach critical thinking within a scientific domain, that presents even more challenge. Now, I don't think we shouldn't do that. It's just that that is something which I think, you know, going back to what we talked about earlier, if we can somehow change the culture so that critical thinking is valued more and people really understand what it is, people understand better what science is, because they often rely upon it, that may help, but I certainly don't have answers to those questions. Another difficulty that I observe in my students, and this is more recent, is that some students really have trouble paying attention and feel compelled to check their cell phones in class, even when this activity is forbidden in class. And what I've been doing in the last probably about 3 years is I give them research where I say, you know, the research shows that if you've got your phone out, it's not just going to distract you, it's going to affect somebody next to you. And that the research shows your grades aren't going to be as good. You're not going to do as well on tests. This is on average, but, you know, and there are just some students who seem almost addicted. I should say that one of the motivators that I use, that it's not unusual, I think all instructors use it, is grades. And so if there's a consequence to not thinking critically and learning how to do this in a, you know, reasonable way, then their grades are going to suffer. And if they do it better, and usually I get improvement in performance. You know, we've already seen that with the research, but, you know, most students want to work for grades because they have the very practical goal of making it through college and what comes after. But of course, that creates a dilemma because instructors like me want to see not just this extrinsic motivation where people are working for grades, but also that they're intrinsically interested. Oh, that's an interesting question, you know, and I'd like to find out more about it. And hopefully that then they will use their new skills when they're out of college, you know, and I know that's part of your definition, lifelong learning. That's a very real challenge with students, my own as well. And so that brings us to the other part of your question. Relatedly, inducing students to incorporate critical thinking into their basic lives, that's perhaps the biggest and most important challenge. And I would say that oftentimes that's the one that isn't reached, or we don't solve that problem in education. And that's partly because it's a very challenging problem. My own research on direct infusion, I would say it shows it's most successful within the context of a course. You know, we do assessment of the end of our program, and we see some improvement in students at the end. But finding out if they're using these skills when they leave college, that's really a difficult task. Not to be discouraged that we should do it, but rather see what we can do. As I mentioned earlier, I try to discuss important questions that are interesting that have consequences for citizens. For example, we do that critical reading exercise on whether eyewitness memory is accurate. It often isn't. And I tell students, you know, if you're ever falsely accused of a crime and you're in court and there's an eyewitness who says they've seen you with certainty, hire a cognitive psychologist who's an expert on memory. I think, you know, giving students access to how they might use information may make it seem more important to them and encourage its use later. But I haven't tested that.
Well, I think one of the, you know, kind of everyday things that are relevant to our lives, especially, you know, it seems like so much in the last few years, is misinformation and disinformation, something Bob and I have talked about a few times. And, you know, one of the prevalent categories of misinformation that we're exposed to on a regular basis is the unsubstantiated conspiracy mm-hmm. theories. Mm-hmm. One of the most toxic and sort of dangerous ones that come to mind of recent is the QAnon conspiracy theory that has led to all kinds of things, including violence. So first of all, what is an unsubstantiated conspiracy theory? And in addition to that, like, what do we know about people who are prone to believing and most of all promoting unsubstantiated conspiracy theories?
Let me address this question by comparing conspiracy theories to good scientific theories, which is what we want our students to learn. Good scientific theories are generalizations about the nature of the world that are consistent with numerous high-quality observations. They're substantiated by this empirical evidence. However, when people believe conspiracy theories, it's not because they're trying to come up with a theory that's logically or empirically consistent with carefully made observations, as a scientist or critical thinker would do. Instead, they often have a grievance or are reacting to some objectionable event, which they attribute to a powerful entity. While scientists make specific predictions from their theories and then test them, conspiracy theorists seldom make such predictions. And more often, they make what we might call postdictions, explaining why something which has already happened occurred the way it did. So these are very after-the-fact kinds of explanations. As such, they're not like scientific theory. So when we call something a conspiracy theory, that's using the word theory pretty liberally. Now, a good example is the unsubstantiated Pizzagate conspiracy theory, which proposed that Hillary Clinton and her liberal campaign team were part of a child sex trafficking ring headquartered at the DC Comet Ping Pong Pizzeria. Now, if this were a real scientific theory, then objective observation should have confirmed it. But when Edgar Welch stormed the pizzeria, shot off his assault rifle, and thoroughly searched the premises, he was surprised to find no evidence of the abduction and trafficking of children. After DC police apprehended him, he still thought that there might be sex trafficking going on there. But the police reported no such practice, nor did any of this emerge in his subsequent trial, for which he was convicted. Now, this conspiracy theory seems to be unsubstantiated because it lacks evidence to substantiate it. Accepting this kind of unsubstantiated theory involves a thinking error, making a hasty generalization, or jumping to a conclusion before adequate evidence has been mustered. Or let's examine the derivative QAnon conspiracy theory, which incorporated the Pizzagate conspiracy and other conspiracy theories. QAnon's really a hodgepodge of conspiracy theories, some of them very old. Online followers were deliberately encouraged to find patterns based on the Q drops or vague statements made by an anonymous person said to have Q security clearance in the US government. Out of this conspiracy theorizing came the vague prediction of the storm in which Donald Trump was expected to vanquish his enemies. If the attack on the US Capitol was actually the storm, then this was more of a self-fulfilling prophecy that was actively created by QAnon supporters than a prediction which they based on careful observation. The prediction that Trump would vanquish his enemies failed. If anything, he made more enemies. Nor was the conspiracy theory that the election was fixed against Trump substantiated when nearly 60 court cases found no election fraud, making this conspiracy theory unsubstantiated because it's been carefully studied and shown to be false. Now, the problem with trying to determine whether a conspiracy theory is substantiated or not is that there are so many conspiracy theories, with new ones arising all the time. So it's not practical or feasible to examine them all. The ones that have been shown to be unsubstantiated have been shown to be inconsistent with high-quality research, as I mentioned before, and objective evidence, such as the claim that the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center was an inside job. But evidence of the attack, tracing jihadists to the flight school, Osama bin Laden's confession, clearly showed that this was not an inside job. So this was one of those that's been unsubstantiated. But others pop up and remain unsubstantiated conspiracy theories because no good evidence has been brought up to support them. Nevertheless, because no good evidence supports them, we shouldn't jump to believe them. Okay. Now, going back to your other part of your question, we've tried to study specific conspiracy theories that have been unsubstantiated by high quality evidence or have not had such evidence brought forward. Another strategy that we've used that I think is kind of interesting is to make up specific fictitious conspiracies, such as the government has been secretly broadcasting messages and is in contact with alien beings from another planet. We had an item like that. Using these measures, we recently found that those who accepted more false and fictitious claims tended to show reliable individual differences from those who endorse them less. We found that they're more intuitive, they trust their intuition, their hunches more, their experience, personal experience. They tend to be more cynical, That is, they mistrust the motives of people, and especially people in the government and authorities, scientists. Related to this, we found in one study that they also showed higher levels of subclinical paranoia, fear and distrust. And related to, on a positive side to critical thinking, those people who were more scientifically skeptical, trusted science more, trusted the approach of science, but not were more just generally skeptical, tended to believe, accept the conspiracy theories less. Now, finally, we've also recently found that people who endorse one kind of unsubstantiated claim more than other people also tend to accept other types more, such as paranormal beliefs, pseudoscientific claims, and psychological misconceptions. These same dispositions, cognitive style differences, that is, they're related to critical thinking, also tended to predict these other types of unsubstantiated claims or beliefs.
I want to say that those categories that you just mentioned, unsubstantiated beliefs, is one of the things that brought you to our attention here on Thinking Clearly. I read a recent article in the Skeptical Inquirer. It was titled, "I Can't Believe You Believe That, Identifying Unsubstantiated Claims." And one of the things I really liked about that article as I was reading it is that you first gave six examples of claims like unsubstantiated conspiracy theory, unsubstantiated pseudoscience claim, those kinds of things that you just talked about. And doing that gets us thinking right away about substantiation of claims. It brings right visible to us that claims can be unsubstantiated. That means there's ways of substantiating those claims. And it also gets us thinking about the different categories they fall into. So that kind of gets our analytical gears turning right away. And I like that about that article. So just kind of walk us through some of the takeaways briefly of that article, types of unsubstantiated claims, scientific plausibility, and how to determine the probability of claims being substantiated or unsubstantiated.
I'm glad you read that article, Bob, because that brought me here, and I'm happy to be here to talk to you guys about this. Well, in that article, two important points I tried to make were that first, there are other types of unsubstantiated claims besides conspiracy theories, such as paranormal claims, pseudoscientific claims, and psychological misconceptions. And second, although they are all similar in that they are unsubstantiated and are difficult to distinguish in real-world examples, there are, nevertheless, strategies we can employ to help us decide if some of these claims are likely to be true or false. Before I do this, let me review a little more about what makes these unsubstantiated. So I'm going to talk about pseudoscience, paranormal belief, and misconceptions. And then we'll look at some strategies that might help us to reduce these beliefs and identify them. First of all, pseudoscience, as its name implies, is false science. It masquerades as real science, with the proponents of pseudoscience claiming that certain theories, practices, or effects are scientific. That is, that they've been supported by scientific research using high-quality scientific procedures, although they have not been. Despite appearances, pseudoscience is unsubstantiated by high-quality scientific evidence. The initial support for a connection between autism and vaccines came from a fraudulent and poorly conducted case study that was somehow published in the prestigious British medical journal Lancet. But the connections were not found in high-quality studies. Although this article was retracted and its main author, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, lost his medical license over the whole scandal, some people persisted in believing that the claim was scientifically supported. Now, this is a clear sign of pseudoscience. When there's good evidence to the contrary that something isn't based on scientific research and high-quality evidence, but you still say it's scientific. This brings us to paranormal belief. paranormal believers often claim that extraordinary events occur, often initiated by people with extraordinary abilities, such as adepts at extrasensory perception, who engage in, for example, mind-to-mind communication without any physical means. Or paranormal believers claim that the mind spirit of certain adepts could leave the body in astral projection. Or that a ghost, a disembodied spirit without a functioning brain, could somehow communicate with the living who have functioning nervous systems. How's that happen? These paranormal phenomena typically defy explanation from conventional science. These claims remain unsubstantiated, not only because they're inconsistent with physics and psychology usually, but also because research findings support ESP and such phenomena have not been replicated consistently. So every once in a while they'll find something, oh, look, this shows ESP works, and then they're unable to replicate it. Well, in science, we have to be able to repeat observations objectively. Now, other paranormal research by self-styled paranormal investigators in our town, every once in a while, there's an ad in the newspaper about these people that are ghost hunting. They often use pseudoscientific procedures. For instance, electromagnetic field detectors, EMF detectors, they use them in procedures that only appear to be scientific, to support the existence of ghosts. So not only are they making paranormal claims, but they're also using pseudoscience to support them. The result is the same as with higher quality paranormal research. In both cases, the findings fail to substantiate the paranormal claims.
You know, the last grains of sand are just about to fall out of our hourglass here. So there's so much more in that article, yeah. And there's so much more to talk about. We probably need a whole second show with you. I encourage our listeners to look up that article in Skeptical Inquirer. Hopefully you're subscribing to Skeptical Inquirer. It's a great magazine. What issue is that in?
February issue. And I have another article that's related to this, and I've talked about a couple ideas from it. And I'm not sure when it's going to appear, but pretty soon, maybe this summer.
In Skeptical Inquirer.
In Skeptical Inquirer.
I will put your author profile from Skeptical Inquirer into our show links. So, Alan Bensley, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time and your knowledge and experience with us. So, on our Facebook page, we'll post a link to your books. And like I mentioned, the author profile at Skeptical Inquirer. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
That's good for now, but I do want to thank you for hosting this. Sorry I went a little long. There was a lot to say.
It's such a broad subject. It keeps expanding in my mind, too, as to just all the related issues there are to critical thinking. And I want to do give a big thanks to our listeners for your interest and your support for Thinking Clearly. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.